What are the ethics of travel writing in this age of social media? Is anything off limits? That question will be the subject of a panel discussion at the Hawaii Book and Music Festival this weekend. New Yorker magazine staff writer William Finnegan knows well the pitfalls of publicizing travel. While on a multi-year surfing expedition, Finnegan and his companion discovered every surfer's white whale, the so-called perfect wave. But that discovery did not remain secret for long. The story is chronicled in Finnegan's Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. He'll be part of a panel at the Book and Music Festival this weekend. He sat down with our producer, Ryan Finnerty, to share his story, and he started with the title of his book.
Well, I called the book Barbarian Days in part because of what surfing has represented in Hawaii and around the world at different times and different contexts. People probably remember the what Hiram Bingham, he was the leader of a group of Calvinist missionaries from New England who started arriving in Hawaii in 1820, and he famously wrote, this missionary party found itself in a crowd of surfers, I think, before it even landed, and Bingham famously wrote, quote, "The appearance of destitution, degradation, and barbarism among the chattering and almost naked savages whose heads and feet and much of their sunburnt swarthy skins were bare was appalling. Some of our number, with gushing tears, turned away from the spectacle," unquote. So as a sort of starting point, the sort of Calvinist missionary view of surfing. And then just about as famously, Bingham, when he, I think, was finally leaving Hawaii, 27 years later anyway, wrote this other well-known line, quote, "The decline and discontinuance of the surfboard as civilization advances may be accounted for by the increase in modesty, industry, and religion," unquote. Of course, the colonization of Hawaii had much more serious consequences than its impact on surfing, but it did nearly extinguish surfing. And in some way, I see surfing as, not as barbarian, I use that word ironically, but as a kind of passive resistance almost to the sort of Calvinist business values that the missionaries brought, and as they tried to, get people into the cash economy and out of the traditional way of life.
I think that first Bingham quote when he first arrived in Hawaii is really interesting because what he saw was overwhelmingly negative, but someone else in that time arriving on the shores of one of the Hawaiian islands might have viewed that scene very differently. And you moved to Hawaii when you were in middle school. How did other people's perceptions of what was going on in Hawaii in the surf scene or otherwise influence you when you first arrived here? And did your real life experience differ from those expectations?
Yeah, I had, we moved to Hawaii when I was 13. My dad got a job there. We were living in Southern California. But you mentioned what other people coming to Hawaii, besides me, I'll answer that, but might have seen as opposed to the sort of negative, horrified view, the gushing tears, no less, of Hiram Bingham and his missionaries. There's also a quote, I don't have it to hand, but James Cook, the British explorer who stumbled upon the Hawaii, described, this may have been somebody in an outrigger in Tahiti, but I think it was Hawaii. Anyway, he described the feeling that these people riding the waves had as, this must be the most supreme pleasure. So he had the sort of opposite take to these missionaries. And I, coming along in the 60s, had been surfing a few years, and so my expectations were very heavily shaped by surf magazines and surf movies and all these, incredible pictures, mainly of North Shore spots, Sunset Beach and the Pipeline. And then when we got to Hawaii in January, I guess it was, we lived over on Kulumanu, kind of behind Diamond Head near Black Point, and looked completely different. It wasn't at all what I expected. It wasn't this, sort of powder blue giant waves with offshore winds. It was more modest, and the winds tended to be sideshore. But I was really, really happy to be there, and just loved. I mean, I started surfing out front, or paddle down to the right to Diamond Head Cliffs and all the little reef breaks around there.
One of the most famous surf films of all time, and especially during your youth, was Endless Summer. And as you approached adulthood, you ended up taking a pretty extensive surf trip of your own, which is chronicled in Barbarian Days. How did that film or others like it or magazine articles, how did that influence your path, both as a surfer and as a writer or a traveler?
Well, that film specifically had a huge impact on me, and I think a lot of young surfers in my generation. It was incredibly exciting, and they find this so-called perfect wave in South Africa. But and I ended up feeling like when I grew up, I had to do that also. Like it was almost mandatory. That's what one did. And I had a friend who felt the same way. And so in our 20s, when, we finished school and saved a bit of money, we set off on a trip that for me lasted 3.5 years, kind of going around the world surfing. The funny thing about that really, though, is that Endless Summer was not a documentary. We thought of it as like these two guys go traveling and somebody happens to film them. But in fact, I think the film was Bruce Brown's idea, the filmmaker, and he, basically hired these guys to star in it, a couple of the best surfers of the day, Mike Hinson and Robert August. So it was really more of a, photo shoot or a film job, not what they did with their lives. So that only dawned on me much later that we'd, taken this stuff as real and to be emulated, when perhaps it was more of a fantasy fulfilled for young surfers. But either way, we did head to the South Pacific and eventually Australia, Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, South Africa. I mean, just kept going for years. My friend Brian DeSalvatore and I did the first part of it together, and then I kept going.
And while you were on that trip, you had your own discovery of a so-called perfect wave on the island of Tavarua in Fiji, which is now a five-star resort. But when you first found it, it was a deserted island overrun with snakes that even the local fishermen rarely went to. And you've sort of lived to see the life cycle of that discovery, from unknown to heavily commercialized and commodified. And could you just explain for everyone listening, what was it like to make such a significant discovery, and then how has its arc from then until now, what has it been like to witness that?
Well, you describe it well. Although Brian and I weren't the very first people to surf it, we knew of two guys who'd surfed it before us off a yacht, which was part of how we found it. We'd been surfing through Samoa and Tonga and Fiji and found some pretty good waves, but you're always looking for better ones. And we got some picked up in little clues and hints about a great wave out in West Fiji. And finally, through a long series of lucky breaks, found Tavarua, which was, as you say, uninhabited at the time. And it's a little small island in a chain on a barrier reef. And we got some fishermen to take us from the big island, a few miles across the channel, and drop us off there. And there was no fresh water on the island, so we needed them to come back with supplies regularly. And so we just camped, and it is a great, great wave. This is a wave now known among surfers as restaurants, because of a restaurant that's built there now that helps you line up the wave. But there's another wave, another great wave just off there called Cloud Break, out to sea about a mile and to the south, and And we never saw that when we were there, which was people thought was strange, but it's hard to see from the island, and it's more consistent out there. So we sat on Tauru and waited for the island wave to work. It was fairly fickle, but it was incredible. It was, both of us agreed that, you know, and we'd both been surfing probably 15 years at that point, and it was the best wave we'd ever surfed. And then at the end of that surf season, when we left, a couple other yachts had come by. So there was a little group of us that knew about it, Australians and Americans. And we had a kind of, you know, blood oath to never tell anybody about it, where it was. In fact, my friend Brian and I never said the name Tavarua for years and years. We had little, you know, code names we used instead. We were so paranoid about anybody finding it. That's how surfers can be about, you know, discoveries. And meanwhile, unbeknownst to us, other people had found it, which I discovered when I picked up a surf magazine in the 80s, and it's maybe 5 years after we'd been there, and there it was splashed across the cover.
To your horror, I imagine.
My horror, yes, considerably, and to Brian's. And we planned to go back, but you know, in our own sweet time, and thinking it was just sort of waiting there for us chastely. Not true. And a couple of American guys who'd been among those who made their way there had leased the island from the government and had built a resort. And like the first surfing resort, at least the first one I was aware of. So it was a strange idea, you know, a sort of privatized wave. And it wasn't just the wave on the island. By then, they'd found Cloudbreak. So it was these two great waves. So, yeah, we were both really disappointed and kind of, I wouldn't say bitter, but, you know, not happy about it. And then years passed, and, you know, I got older and eventually could afford to go back there. Because it's not a cheap trip, not a cheap place to stay. And started surfing Cloudbreak on that first trip. I sort of swallowed my principles about privatizing of the wave and the resort and everything else just because I wanted to surf it. Sort of politically indefensible, but true. And I really loved Cloudbreak. And so I started going back constantly for about, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. I was there whenever I could afford it. And then it was open to the public. They lost their lease, their agreement with the government, and got a lot more crowded and like other surf spots, and I've actually stopped going.
You know, for whatever reason, it seems like a lot of the best waves in the world tend to be in less developed countries, and a lot of them tend to be very dependent on tourism. What do you view as the sort of the ethics of surf travel and having these sort of expensive Western-catered resorts adjacent to very poor communities, very isolated in some cases? And since you saw the progression in Fiji from sort of the undeveloped subsistence lifestyle to now there's this Western influx of money, what's the outcome like for the people who are living there?
Well, usually it's what I've seen, not just in Tauru, but other places in Latin America and Indonesia. It's pretty gross. I mean, a place will go from, you know, perhaps a subsistence economy, fishing, farming, you know, in great poverty, to a tourist economy, a service economy, perhaps with some, you know, sort of fishing and farming still going on, but kids sort of growing up around this money they see that the Westerners bring surfers and other tourists and often getting into surfing and not, you know, following in the footsteps of their parents. And it could be really disruptive and destructive. On the other hand, it can bring a measure of prosperity to an area if you know the development is halfway controlled and wisely managed. That's kind of the exception. but one does see the sort of inequality is remains gross in the places I'm thinking of in Latin America and Southeast Asia, but the local development, including medical facilities, some public health development. I mean, it's never what it should be, but there has been some. So there have been good works, including some pioneered by surfers in some of the sort of overrun surf paradises in Indonesia and in Fiji.
You know, Bill, I'm thinking of a wave in Namibia called Skeleton Bay that was discovered a few years ago, but it wasn't discovered by people going out and physically exploring the way you did. It was found on Google Earth as part of a you know, an online competition to discover a new wave. And, you know, do you think, is that the future now? Instead of magazine articles and photographers going out, it's social media and satellite imagery. Is that how the next generation of unknown waves are going to be discovered?
Maybe so. I didn't realize that. I hadn't heard that about Skeleton Bay. I know some South African guys have been surfing it for quite a few years, and I didn't know that was how they found it. But I do know that other discoveries, for instance, there was quite a splash around a right-hand sand bottom point break that Mick Fanning, a great Australian surfer, was filmed at. This is within the last year or two. And, you know, everybody immediately wanted to know where it was. Of course, you know, this incredible wave, he's the only guy around. And then everybody knew. I mean, somehow they figured it out and they, you know, pinned it. And it was, I think it's in Ghana or somewhere. I mean, it's somewhere quite remote. But the mystery didn't last. And that's sort of a ethos of a generation past, I'm afraid, that, you know, the keeping the secret sort of thing.
You know, surfing is one of those activities that is very individualistic in a lot of ways, and having too many people out in the water can kind of diminish the experience for everyone. Do you think we're running the risk of a sort of tragedy of the commons with a lot of these waves?
Yeah, I do. That's exactly what it is. You know, each person is sort of pursuing their own interest, and the net result is the sort of destruction of the common good. And surfing is a great example of, you know, overpopulation and its discontents. It's the main reason, I think, why we travel and, you know, bushwhack to try to find places that other people haven't surfed before. It's just to escape the crowds at the known spots. I mean, there's also the sort of thrill and beauty of it if you happen to find something good. But it's the real driver, I think, is mainly to get away from crowds.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning author William Finnegan talking to our conversation producer Ryan Finnerty. He'll be at the Honolulu Book and Music Festival this weekend, and you can find details on Finnegan's speaking events on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.